Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
Don't know who's looking forward to this more, Narina Fisser or me. Certainly, I hope you were looking forward to it. Strategist and advisor at ETF SA, Narina Fisser, has been around the markets for a while. You understand markets. You've studied markets. You've participated in markets. You've been a market activist. You are a participant in markets for a while, Narina. A little bit of a history lesson without dates. No dates are necessary. But just give us an overview of the life of Narina in markets.
Let's just say it's been since the previous century, Bruce. Does that sound long enough ago?
It's further and further away, you know, Narina. And that's the trouble with the previous century.
Indeed, indeed. And yet I only really formally sort of got into introduced to markets in my 30s. I was, in fact, for the first 30 years of my life, knew nothing about markets and investments and money and finance and all of this good stuff. And yes, came to this literally in my 30s, and it was a love affair at first sight. And
what did you do before markets? I can't imagine you not in markets.
Colloquially, I was referred to as a rocket scientist, Bruce. So, yes, I actually worked in the defense industry, and I helped design the missiles and weapon systems on the Rooivalk attack helicopter.
I take it with respect, and you see me sitting up straight, and I now go, okay, yes, ma'am. Look at that. And what was the switch? I mean, what was the catalyst then for markets?
So for me, the love has always been numbers, maths, stats. That's really where it all came from, and it was really, where do I choose to apply this? And yes, the catalyst really was my wonderful husband, who I think obviously knows me better than I know myself. And after having worked in that industry for a couple of years, and I had three children, and we then moved to Cape Town because of his work, and I thought at the time, this is the perfect time for me now to become the housewife, the full-time mommy. I thought that that was what was required of me, and he just sort of looked at me and just smiled and nodded, did not challenge me, but obviously knew this was not going to last. And whilst we were painting a bedroom for the third baby, he called me over and said, I've got a job for you. And I thought this was probably going to be painting skirtings or putting down masking tape or something, but it was actually an advertisement for a quantitative analyst at Old Mutual Asset Managers. Now, I could not even pronounce the word at the time, and I thought that he was high on paint fumes or something similar, and said, what on earth make you think that I can do this job? And he said, now read what they are looking for, the sort of characteristics, the skill set, the interest and so on. And yes, it really was a very good reflection of what I think my core strengths and my skills were. And I guess the real sort of, in addition to my husband for knowing me so well, I think the big thumbs up needs to go to somebody by the name of Adrian Allardyce, who gave me my first job at Old Mutual Asset Managers, and I think who took the massive leap of faith to appoint this young woman who knew absolutely nothing about markets or finance and appoint me to that role as quantitative analyst.
But what you did know is numbers. You understood maths, and you understood statistics, and that is as useful as it is in weapons of mass destruction as it is in markets, which from time to time are referred to as weapons of mass destruction themselves.
Absolutely.
You look at this life in markets. I mean, did you have a financial brain at all? Had you grown up in a household where, I mean, clearly, you know, education was valued, and that's great, but was it an entrepreneurial household, a mathematical household, an investing household?
Definitely not entrepreneurial or investment or finance related, but very much mathematical. My dad was the maths brain. My mom was the word brain. And between the two of them, our lives were spent around lots of word games, number games, lots of games, puzzles. So maybe the whole idea of you know, sort of warfare and gaming and markets and so on was instilled in me then, but certainly not a household that was focused on money or on investments. And in fact, I can't really recall that was ever a topic for conversation. So money was never something that was important growing up. It was, and I think that has really sort of framed where I sit today in terms of money has never been important to me. It is an enabler, and what it can do for me is incredibly important to me, but money per se really is not something which is important to me.
How does your husband feel about that?
I'm very much call it the financial director or the financial manager of the household, and he's very comfortable with that. Even though he does have a BCom degree in investment management, he chose to go and exercise his skill set somewhere quite differently, and so he is very happy to do a lot of the cooking and the brying in the house, and he's also a superb interior decorator. So we certainly do challenge some of those archaic sort of roles, stereotypes in relationships, and it certainly works well for us. And I think we now as a family have a lot more sort of money conversation, certainly than what I had when I grew up. But in large part for me, it's still about money is not really what's important. It's really just about what does it enable us to do, and how do we make sure that we are able to achieve what we want to achieve, do what we want to do, and how do we use money to be that enabler in our lives.
Do you remember having your first job? I mean, you know, in the olden days, people used to do paper rounds or work in the local shop or whatever the case might be. Did you ever do any of those kinds of jobs?
Yes, but not one of the ones that you mentioned. I was actually a piano teacher. So that was my first job. This was at the age of the old what is now grade 10, standard 8 as it was at the time. I did piano or music as a subject for school also. And so at that age, 10 to age of 15. Yep, maths and music. That's my two, the double M.
I'm a believer, but explain to me the connection, please, in this maths music montage.
Well, I think it comes down to the fact that there's a lot of rhythm and counting and pattern to both maths and to music. And it's quite a common occurrence that you find many people who are very mathematically inclined are also superb musicians. And of course, what it does very well also is call on both sides of your brain. And I do think from an sort of a whole brain integrated perspective, I think having both the maths and the music is something which I think serves those of us that are that way positioned. It serves us very well.
And in terms of savings and investments, I mean, were you, and when you were building rocket systems, were you any good at investing? Had you considered the prospect, or did you just have a pension as these things were?
Yeah, certainly had the pension, and I must, to my shame, although I have sympathy for my 22-year-old self, as it was at the time, my very first, and I can't even call it an investment, but first exposure was to one of those horrid package deals, those, you know, sort of life policy combined with an RA type of horrible TV dinner sort of package deals that we got in those days, and which I now despise and try and tell people why that was one of the worst inventions ever for the financial industry. But yeah, that was really my first exposure to it, and I certainly didn't see it as an investment. You know, that was very much along the lines of, you know, you got to do the right thing, and the right thing is that you got to have life insurance. Why you need life insurance when you're 22 years old and you have absolutely no dependence
or no assets.
Exactly. So yeah, unfortunately, that was my first, I guess, call it an investment for lack of a better word.
But she's grown up since then. Her name is Nerina Fisser. She's a strategist and advisor at ETFSA. She went from rocket science into the rocket science and maths of investing, and now is a very strong proponent of direct investment, exchange-traded funds, cutting out the middleman, cutting out the manager, going directly into these ETF products. We'll talk to her about that transition and why the maths makes sense in a bit.
The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
There's a story about a guy called Paul who's on the road to Damascus, and he suddenly has an epiphany. And Nerina had that Damascus moment, strategist and advisor at ETFSA, Nerina Fisser. So at what point did you go from actively managed investing into the exchange-traded funds arena? Because I believe it's probably got something to do with that mathematical brain of yours.
Yeah, so certainly my Damascus moment was at a CFA conference in 2007 here in South Africa, when Deborah Furr, who is known really as the global guru on ETFs and indexed investments, she was one of the speakers there. And it was during her presentation that the penny dropped for me, that even though I knew what ETFs were, and I was certainly very familiar with Satrix 40 being the first ETF that had been listed 7 years prior to that, I didn't quite get what this could do for investments. And that really was my Damascus moment. And I see that as the turning point in my professional career in making a very conscious decision and choose to go down the path of indexed investments exclusively. Not because I necessarily believe that this is the only way that money can be managed, but because I believe that there are more than enough people that are doing it other ways, the more traditional ways, and that there are not nearly enough of us that actually exploit all the incredible benefits that indexed investments and ETFs can bring to the, especially the client, but to the investment industry as a whole.
Okay, now it comes down to, if we're going to do the maths of it, it comes down to a cost discussion. Yeah. It comes down to what an actively managed fund costs versus an exchange traded fund and the different cost structures of both.
Yeah, so, you know, the famous John Bogle wrote a little book called, he referred to it as The Relentless Rules of Humble Arithmetic. And it really comes down to the argument that the net return that all investors in the market can achieve will be the gross return of all underlying investments minus the costs of implementing those investments.
Markets go up and down. Yep. Whether they go up or whether they go down, you pay money for those investments. For investing in those markets, and the performance of your investment will be the gap between the two.
Exactly. So therefore, the smaller or the lower the cost component to it, the higher the net return that you as an investor will achieve. And I think what's quite important to understand is we tend to focus on costs very much around things like management fee maybe, or some of those explicit costs that we see in things like the total expense ratio, the TER. But I think what is completely underestimated is the fact that it is not active management per se that destroys value. It is activity that destroys value. So the more activity you have in an investment portfolio, the higher the costs will be, and the harder it therefore becomes to actually generate returns that compensate you for that higher cost that you incur. And that's where I think the very simple and humble rule of arithmetic comes in, that if you can reduce the amount of activity in a portfolio, you just have so much a better chance of actually achieving a much better net return.
So why then do I not just do the Warren Buffett approach, and that's buy a portfolio of 10 or 12 shares, and I just add to my portfolio? I never sell. I don't trade. I wait for times when share prices go down, and I just add to my share portfolio. I could run my own little investments that way, provided I have discipline and self-discipline. But maybe that's where it all goes wrong, and that is very few of us have that. We panic in, we panic out, we start behaving like day traders when we start second-guessing markets. Perhaps it's psychology that prevents me from doing that.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it, absolutely. But I think we also need to appreciate that there are some things that happen in markets that's even beyond the control of the most patient and conscientious investor. We've experienced many of that in our own market in recent years, where you have corporate actions, where a company like SAB Miller, that was one of the first companies to list on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, was taken out in a corporate transaction by AB InBev, which means that clients that very patiently and very prudently kept those shares all those years ended up in a position where they were forced to pay capital gains tax on a transaction that they really didn't have any choice in doing so. Whereas when your investments are held in the relative tax protective sort of environment of CISCA, the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act, which is really what governs our unit trusts and also our ETF industry, within that vehicle, you don't have those tax implications. So even if you're able to do the right thing.
Lorena, you were there one moment, and the next moment you're gone. I mean, you were saying, we lost you for a second.
I lost you as well for a second. So let's try that again. Right.
So I was worse off than you. When we look at the tax efficiency, yes, of being in an index fund as opposed to owning shares directly, it means that when a buyout like the massive SAB Miller buyout happens, it was at a very attractive price, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm not selling the shares. The underlying, the market is readjusting. So I get the cash benefit to my portfolio, but I don't necessarily get the consequences or the implications.
Well, you get some of the positive consequences, but unfortunately you also get the negative tax consequences, which is that SAR smiles very broadly and says, thank you very much, we'll have ourselves some capital gains tax on that cash windfall that you've just received. So even in a case where an investor is able to control the impulse of buying and selling when he shouldn't be doing so, you still end up in a situation where managing money in an individualized share portfolio cannot ever be as tax or as cost efficient as it can be in a unit trust, or certainly then also in an ETF, which is also a unit trust.
Why do they remain such hard sells as it is? I mean, I know the universe is much bigger and far more people are looking at them, but we're nowhere near, you know, they're not sold as actively, perhaps, as managed funds are.
Well, it's that Warren Buffett that you just quoted also is actually exactly the person who said it's amazing how hard it is for somebody to see what lies in front of him in plain sight when he is paid not to see it. So unfortunately, our investments are still sold in large part in our market. It's not bought. Investments should be bought, and we should be empowered as investors to make informed investment decisions and make our buy decisions. But unfortunately, investments are mostly sold to us, and therefore it is sold often on the basis of what suits the seller's pocket rather than what is best for the buyer, being the investor.
Nerina Visser, thank you so much for coming in. Strategist, advisor at ETF SA, rocket scientist. You see, I learned something new this evening, Nerina. But a mathematician, and has looked at the mathematics of investing and has gone, how are you likely to make the best possible returns? And she's explained it all to us in glorious technicolor this evening. Nerina Visser, what a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bruce. Cheers.